is a Bramble Jam podcast.
Hi, I'm Bran, and if I had to choose, I would pick Christmas movies that were released after 1992.
I'm Alonzo, and I'm here to instruct Bran that there was a cinema before he was born, and this
is the Deck the Hallmark podcast. Yeah. Week five, Alonzo. Woo. Week five. We are, what is that? A fifth of the way there? Is that my
Yes, name? 20%.
Man, how about that? Look at us go. Just chugging along. We are, obviously, for those of you that maybe haven't joined us for whatever reason, Alonzo is letting me know of a movie that I should watch. Came out before 1992 that I haven't seen before. And the next week, I'll tell Alonzo a movie that he should watch that came out after 1992 that he will likely dislike. And but that's not the goal. The goal is not to find a movie that he dislikes. It's just to
either to introduce me to one or to bring me around on something.
That's exactly right.
I didn't get the first.
And so far I'm 0-2, but I got a good feel.
I'm 2-0. You're having a good time here.
I'm having a great time, buddy. I'm having a great time. let's on the 25th week, we are going to be doing a,
user
recommended one. And I saw a comment that we should, I haven't seen this, but it's like lore at this point, which is, what is it? Santa and the Martians?
Santa Claus Conquers the Martians.
Santa Claus. Somebody recommended that one. I've always heard about it. And so I'm going to put it in the back pocket because I think it's a good compromise because it did come out before 1992 and it also sucks. So it could be a really good.
But yes, we're open to other votes. Please vote.
Oh, there's that. Yeah, sure. I got to ask you, I should have asked you last week, but I didn't. A Christmas Story reboot. Where are you at on that? Because we talked about the Santa Claus reboot and we're both like, I am much, you know, I'm pretty optimistic in general, but I'm all in on that. Christmas Story reboot, Peter Billingsley. I am all in on that. And 70s, very intrigued by what they're going to do there. So what is your take on it?
I mean, you know, I want to believe like Fox Mulder. We've been down this road before, as you know. There have been already several attempts to do sequels, follow-ups to A Christmas Story, and they've all been kind of not great.
But not with Peter Billingsley.
But not with Peter Billingsley, granted. That's the thing.
And he's a producer.
Executive producer. And the fact that he doesn't have to do this, clearly he's found other fish to fry over the course of his career. So if he could get talked into doing this again, it would have to be because the script is so good. So yeah, I hope that's the case. I have, like I said, I want to believe. And I think we talked about this, 8-bit Christmas already kind of feels like it's the more modern follow-up to A Christmas Story, but you know, again, with Peter Billingsley now, that could make the difference.
But it's modern, but 70s. So it's not true. Like, so that was 80s.
That was 80s,
So we'll see. We'll see what happens there. But I didn't know that Peter Billingsley was like partners with Vince Vaughn. I had no idea that was a thing.
Yeah, he and Jon Favreau have worked together quite a bit. And in fact, I think that he is a producer on like Iron Man.
Really?
Yeah, he directed them in that movie Couples Retreat. So he's done a lot of he's much more like on the producing angle of things now. So for him to, you know, he did that cameo in Elf, but for him to come back to play the lead and to reprise his, you know, most famous role, I don't think he would do that out of like, oh, I need the check. I think he's doing it out of like, oh, this is a cool project and I want to do it. I hope that's what's happening here.
Yeah, and I'm excited because he's going to be playing the dad. So he's going to be like, how much like his old man will he be?
Sure.
You know, that's always interesting to see.
Is Ralphie now Ralph, you know?
Yeah, is he Ralph? And the movie is filming in Hungary, which I found to be very odd, but.
I guess if you want sort of like, if you want it to look like 70s Detroit, Hungary, you know, Eastern Europe is the place to be now. I don't really know. I do know, like, I mean, Hungary is, currently getting famous for some civil rights abuses, which I certainly hope that movie studios like pay attention to before they start sending productions over there willy-nilly, but that's neither here nor there.
I don't see any pros to doing that. There's like, you know, go to Canada. Like the first one was filmed in Canada, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, the actual house that was in the U.S. like has been, you know, turned into a museum and has been lovingly restored to look exactly the way it does in the movie inside and out. So I would imagine that's going to be a location at least.
Yeah, here's hoping. All right, let's get to your movie. We've been in 1940 for what seems like a few hundred years. So let's see what happens. How far into the future are we going now?
We are taking a big leap forward to
1944. Whoa, boy. 1941 through 43 can kick rocks.
Those years sucked. Yeah, no use for you. That's now, right. This one is legitimately like considered an American classic. And I'm almost positive that you will really love it. If there's any issue you might have with it, is that it is not Christmas from stem to stern. It is kind of a year in the life movie. There's a Christmas section where a lot of memorable stuff happens, where a very memorable song is introduced, but it's not like every single moment of this movie is, you know, covered in tinsel. So just be ready for that.
What are the chances I've heard of this movie?
I'll tell you this. If you haven't heard the movie, you absolutely know the song that is introduced in it. I'll say that much.
Great. All right. Hit me.
The movie from 1944 is Meet Me in St. Louis.
Yeah, I know that name.
Starring Judy Garland, directed by Vincent Minnelli, who would become her husband. And it is set at the turn of the 20th century. It is about a family and their excitement over the fact that the World's Fair is going to be coming to St. Louis, and the sorrow of the possibility that they might all wind up moving to New York City before the great event happens. And during the memorable holiday segment of this film, Judy Garland, to her young co-star Margaret O'Brien, sings
Have Yourself a
Merry Little Christmas.
There it is.
So Brand's ever seen this movie, and now he's going to see it.
I've heard her sing it. So,
okay, well, that's a start.
So there you go. I'm excited about it. I mean, it's Judy Garland. What's not to love, you know?
This was considered her first adult role, even though she's playing like, you know, older teenager. But it was definitely, a move forward from like playing, you know, Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz and other sort of like more juvenile parts she was doing up until that point.
And at least it's streaming, which is great news for everybody.
Oh, good. Yes. I know. Again, my apologies about last time when I made the list. Remember the night was streaming, but it just disappears sometimes when you turn around too long.
It'll be back, everybody. It'll be back. All right. I'm going to go watch it. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about Meet Me in St. Louis here on Deck the Hallmark. And we're back. We did it. We watched it. Meet Me in St. Louis. I mean, I don't know why. I mean, I know why I wasn't cast. But I like to think.
If they do a remake, you know, they got your number.
That's exactly right. Also, I mean, I know now why you like this movie.
Oh,
so
it's funny. I forget about that between viewings that there are two characters in this movie named Alonzo, but they spell it with a Z.
Yeah. Well, the first, I felt like I was like, did they say Alonzo? Sure. Doesn't strike me as a 1940s name.
Well, it's a 1903. They usually abbreviate it to Lon, which I have never, ever done.
Lon. Oh, I love that.
No.
That sounds sexy, Lon.
Don't even start wrapping that around your head. That is not Lon. Happening. No. Save that for Lon Chaney.
Let's talk Mimi and St. Louis. Alonzo. Give us a little synopsis if you don't mind. I'm not going to do the magic that you did last week.
Oh, man. And you're not, I demand the sound bed. Okay,
fine. You know what? I'll do it. I'll do it for you.
I appreciate it.
You got to do a whole thing. Meet Me in St. Louis, originally aired.
Oh, you're right. Sorry. Meet Me in St. Louis, originally played in theaters in 1944. And it went a little something like this.
That is not the right song.
No, we're not doing Deliverance.
Oh my gosh.
A little something like this. The 1904 World's Fair is still a year away, but the Smith family of St. Louis can hardly wait for this international event to come to their hometown. In the meantime, they've got plenty to keep them busy. Second oldest daughter, Esther, played by Judy Garland, has fallen in love with John Truett, who has just moved in next door. Oldest daughter, Rose, hopes she'll soon be engaged. And youngest daughter, Tootie, always manages to get herself in trouble, no matter what the season. Just before Christmas, Mr. Alonzo Smith drops a bombshell. He's accepted a promotion that will take him to New York City, and the whole family will be leaving St. Louis right after Christmas. Will the rest of the Smith family be ready to leave behind their lives, their friends, and their beloved hometown? There's a Christmas ball, and they're going to make big decisions, and it's all going to work out. And that was Meet Me in St. Louis.
Nailed it, buddy.
Thank you.
Oh, man. All right.
That makes everything better. What can I tell you?
Yeah, that's true. It really does. Especially that banjo.
For sure. Oh, yeah.
Really? I was trying a new thing. It didn't work.
The Country Bear Jamboree.
I was trying a new thing. All right. Let's talk about it. Yes. Alonzo, I'll let you go first. This was your choice. So tell me why you chose it. And then, you know, upon rewatching, what your thoughts were.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a movie where I certainly realized over the time that I was doing the book that there are Christmas movies that are very much like centered on Christmas, that they all take place, you know, in the last half of December. And it's all the discussions are about Christmas and all the decorations are about Christmas. And then there are other movies in which, you know, it's a year in the life. And part of that year is Christmas. And then however significant that Christmas sequence does or doesn't maybe make it a Christmas movie. That movie Hustlers a couple years ago with Jennifer Lopez has a pretty big Christmas sequence in it. A lot of people are like, oh, does this count as a Christmas movie? And I'm like, if you think it does, sure. There's a lengthy sequence that involves like gift exchange and a big tree and all that stuff. So yeah, this is a movie that starts in the summer of 1903 and ends in the spring of 1904. So there is a Christmas sequence in the film, but it is a huge, huge, very important Christmas sequence, if for no other reason than Judy Garland introduces the world to the song Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. And so while this is not as like steeped in holiday, 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 the way like, you know, Hallmark movies have trained us to accept, I think it absolutely still counts as a Christmas movie. I think that when we think about this movie, we don't think about the Halloween segment, although the Halloween segment is funny and charming. We don't think about, you know, summer or other things that happen in the film. We think about Christmas.
So what you're saying is that Hustlers is the Meet Me in St. Louis of our day.
Basically, yes.
That's what I got. Century out of everything you said, that's what I got. Hustlers. Yeah, so this is what I'll say. I loved the Christmas part of this movie. The snowman, which what were they made out of? I don't know, but it certainly wasn't snow, especially when she's breaking them.
They were and pretty solid.
She is just whacking that one, and it is not budging. God bless her. She was a mess. But gosh, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. Watching it, it's so good.
Yeah.
And was it Tootie?
Tootie, yes.
She's everybody like listening and watching her Judy Garland sing it because it's just so good. If you're not moved by it, there's something wrong with you, Dan.
Yes, to see your doctor. There is. It's funny because like that is a song that has become a staple. But a lot of the people who sing it change the lyrics a little bit. So it's not like poignant, which it is in the film. Like it, and apparently the original, the sort of Hollywood lore, the original version of the film was the song was even sadder.
Oh wow.
It was like, you know, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, It May Be Your Last or something like that. And Judy Garland was like, I am not singing this to console a young girl who is upset. Like, no, rewrite, please. And so we got to where it is now. But yeah, a lot of people who cover it will leave out, you know, muddle through and the sort of the more kind of heart-wrenching things in that song. And, you know, I think there are some really good covers over the years. My husband is like, Judy, and I don't want to hear anybody else do it. I don't. Frank Sinatra, Elvis Gerald, yeah, they're fine. They're great. This is Judy's song. Judy sings it.
It's so interesting, too. There's something about Judy's voice.
Yeah.
That it's not typically the type of voice, like overly, like, I don't know. There's something about her voice that is just really special that I love.
It's not pretty, but it's so packed with emotion, you know?
Yeah.
I think, like there are certain, you know, take her seriously or not, Karen Carpenter, I think, shares a lot of that quality. There's something in that voice that's just like this sort of honey-coated dagger where it's like it just gets you, you know, when you listen to her.
And it like invites you in somehow to like you just feel like you're there when you're listening to her. The thing that strikes me as I'm watching, like, I get sad when I watch Judy. Because I know of all of the things that like were happening to her due to the system. And it's just tough watching it, you know, knowing all the things that were done to her and at her expense, which is just unfortunate. The Christmas sequence is fantastic in this movie. I think it's my least favorite of the ones that you've brought. I was a little bit bored waiting for the Christmas. Like I liked the first part and then I was like, all right, here we are. We're happening now. And then Christmas came along and I'm like, yes, this is it. And the Christmas stuff did not disappoint. Best part of the movie by far.
Now, if you had watched this out of the context of this show where we're talking about Christmas movies and just sort of taking it at as a movie at face value, would you have liked it more?
I don't think so. No, okay. I think knowing that Christmas was coming was what was keeping me engaged.
The trolley song didn't keep you engaged?
The trolley song was fine. Yes.
Brand.
The trolley song was fine. I'm sorry.
The trolley song is like a classic of American cinema. Come on.
Yeah, the trolley song was fine.
Oh, I weep for your generation.
It's no Hustlers. I'll say that.
J-Lo is our Judy. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, man. Inviting is one word you could use. Gosh. What? She has a new movie coming out. Who's that with Owen Wilson?
Yeah. I haven't seen it yet, but it's coming up.
I can't wait. Like, it just looks like something.
What I think is really cool about this movie, I mean, there's obviously it has an interesting kind of place in the Judy Garland context. Like, this was sort of her bridge from juvenile roles to, you know, leading lady. This was her most grown up part to date, even though she's still playing a teenager. And she wound up marrying Vincent Minnelli, who directed the film, and, you know, they're Liza's parents. But I think the movie itself is really interesting in that. For one thing, it's not like super plot driven. It's really just kind of like a year in the life of this family.
It's ensemble driven for sure.
Yeah. And these things happen and, you know, we just kind of move along. It's, you know, it's a nostalgia piece even for then. I mean, this is a movie set in 1943 that came out in 1903 that came out in 44, which would be like making a movie about 1981 now, basically. So for a lot of people in the audience, that era was not, you know, was something they had some firsthand memory of. I also think it's really interesting in that the men have very little to do in this movie and really only exist as the objects of desire of the women and sort of prizes to be won by the women. I'm speaking mainly about Warren Sheffield and John Truett. Like, they barely exist as characters. And usually in movies of this era and the current era, you will see movies where it's all about the men and the men's drives and the men's desires and wants, and the female characters are sort of just there as prizes to be won. And so the men are like, I want him to kiss me, I want him to ask me to marry him, but who is he? We don't know. We barely spend any time with him. He doesn't matter. It's the women's stories that are important here. Even the dad in this movie, all he does is make like a terrible decision that he then has to fix. Like, that's it. That's all he does.
The guys have so little to do in this movie that when Warren comes in and says we're getting married, and that's it. The dad hasn't even met him. Doesn't know who this guy is. Exactly. That's how little they have to do in this movie. They don't even know who each other are.
The grandpa, actually, I will say, gets a delight. He gets some great moments. Yes.
Yeah. So in short, my least favorite of the three that I've seen so far. Okay. I still enjoyed it.
Good.
But I don't know. It was Judy Garland's great. That's all I'll say. She's a delight.
She is.
There's a reason why she's a legend, and she's just so good.
This is one of the handful of movies that like you absolutely have to see. Like I think everybody, you are born in this country having seen The Wizard of Oz somehow. Like it's just part of our collective DNA. But if you want to move past that, this is definitely one to check out.
Give me a quick history lesson on color, Technicolor, and so. Because Wizard of Oz came out like what?
39.
Five years before this. And there was color. Was there color in the original?
The middle of the Wizard of Oz has always been in color. Yes.
Right. Okay. So that's in color. And then 40, she's in this movie and there's color.
Yeah.
But then there were movies made in between that obviously we watched them. They're not.
Sure.
So why was it such a sparse thing, and when did it become the norm?
I mean, Technicolor obviously was expensive, and it was, you know, it was a more complicated process. You had to light it differently. Like Judy Garland was no doubt sweating buckets having to wear all those pinafores and all those layers under the very bright lights required to shoot a Technicolor movie. You know, there were experimental stabs at color like very early in film. And then in the 30s, you get the movie called Becky Sharp that comes out that's based on the novel Vanity Fair. And that's technically thought of as like the first sort of color film. And by, you know, 39 is Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind. So like you could do it. The technology existed, but everything wasn't automatically just going to be in color by default. And so, you know, you look at musicals, yes, and obviously sort of big splashy historical epics like Gone with the Wind. But for the most part, like a lot of movies are still in black and white, and Technicolor is sort of a selling point. It's like 3D, you know, but it's not the norm yet. And it's really like up through like the 60s, people are still kind of doing black and white as a fallback. You know, like I think the last black and white movie to win Best Picture at the Oscars before Schindler's List was The Apartment, which comes out in 1960. And in the 60s, you're still seeing like smaller dramas, you know, shot in black and white, but color is more and more becoming the standard, especially as more and more people own color televisions. I think that probably that drives the industry to be like, well, we need to, you know, because eventually we want to sell these movies to TV and people don't want to see black and white on television or whatever. But in this era, they're kind of holding it off for like splashier productions like this. And so this is MGM, like when they're really rocking, you know, a lot of the old studios sort of had their signature thing, like Universal had the monsters and Warner Brothers had the gangster movies and MGM obviously had the musicals. And there's a producer named Arthur Freed who produced this film, who had started out as a songwriter and then became a producer. And he is responsible for, when we think about like the great MGM musicals, like he was the guy behind Singing in the Rain. He's the guy behind Gigi and a lot of these other films, like the Freed unit, as it was called, because it was like him and certain directors that he worked with and certain cinematographers and like the whole kind of crew of, you know, people that made these films happen. The Freed unit is sort of thought of as like the gold standard of the classic Hollywood musical. And this is one of the films that came out of that period.
Gotcha. So is it like kind of like IMAX? Like you needed special equipment. It's a lot more expensive to shoot it.
You didn't in a theater the way you do with IMAX.
Right.
On the production side, absolutely. It was because you had to light it a certain way, and then you had to develop it a certain way, and it was definitely gonna add a chunk to your budget. And so you did that for movies that, you know, sort of required that level of spectacle where you really needed it to sort of make up for the fact of what it was going to cost.
I love it. Thank you for the history lesson.
Sure. And what you see in that period of Technicolor also, like if you notice at the, like at the big, at the house party that they throw for Lon going away to Princeton, like all the girls' dresses are in different shades.
Yeah.
You know, like everybody, like there's the purple girl and the beige girl and the red girl, you know, like, and around this time, like MGM does a Three Musketeers remake with like Gene Kelly and Lana Turner. And like each Musketeer has a color. You know, they're always color coded, and that was sort of an early Technicolor thing of like, look at the rainbow here, you know, and like this is also how you're going to keep these characters straight. You're just going to remember, oh, he's the one in brown, and she's the one in blue. You know,
funny, interesting. Let's do the Christmas cheer. Where does this land for you on a sliding scale of Christmas?
High. I mean, I know it doesn't deliver, you know, from stem to stern the way that you might like in these films, but I think when it's giving you Christmas, it is giving you Christmas. You know, the snow, the gigantic old, you know, style of trees that are more sort of like, they aren't perfectly conical, you know, which I love in old movies. How much of that section of the plot revolves around Christmas itself in terms of, you know, when we're moving and the ball and, you know, Tootie and the presents and all that stuff. So I would go 8, even though it's not, even though it's just a percentage of the film. I think when they do it, they lean in hard.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think like as a whole, it's like, you know, 40% of the movie, so you can give it a 4. But like the Christmas that's there is hardcore. I mean, there's a part when they go from like the dance to getting to the room where she sings, where there's the score, it's like an instrumental Christmas, but it's like a montage of different Christmas songs. Mm. It goes in between like 3 different songs, and it's just the way that it is, the music is just so good. It's so good.
It's the soundtrack inside Brand's head.
Oh, all the time, man. No doubt. It was so good. Obviously, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. Like, you can't beat that.
Yeah.
So, like, the Christmas that's there is real good. And I'll just say this. Like, kudos. I've never thought to do this before, but they all wake up in the middle of the night and they realize it's Christmas. And
so
instead of going back to sleep, they say, let's just knock this out right now. Let's just do this thing. Let's open presents. So kudos to them for just, you know.
Weirdly enough, that's kind of how my family used to do it. When I was a little kid, I would go to bed waiting for Santa, and then like they would wake me up at like 2 o'clock in the morning.
Wow.
Yeah. Because, you know, the idea was like Santa just came. And I think also because my mom would usually, and other people in my family would go to midnight mass. So they would go to midnight mass, come home, wake me up, we'd open presents, and then we'd all collapse.
Okay. I can see that. I can see that. As somebody who doesn't go to midnight mass, if you think I'm waking my kid up at 2 a.m., you've lost your mind. But if I'm already up, I can see.
It's funny. Like the next generation happened. Like my siblings started having kids. They're like, oh, no, we're not waking our kids up in the middle of the night.
You
like,
don't
we're
mess
not,
with that.
We're not messing with their sleep schedule. Like that's not happening.
You don't mess with sleep. What is wrong with your parents?
I was the 7th kid. By that point, they were like, whatever. You know?
Yeah, that's fair. All right. Let's recommend something.
Yes.
Watching this, what kind of comes to mind, Alonso, that maybe is something else I haven't seen that you think of when you're watching this movie?
Well, like I was saying before, I think this is a, if you're looking at the you know, sadly, brief, but still like, you know, incredibly dense career of Judy Garland. This movie, I think, kind of marks a really important middle point between like Wizard of Oz and what would come later. And so then I think to sort of check out the back end where she really matures into a really powerful, I mean, not that she ever wasn't, but I mean, like as a full on mature adult actress and singer, I would say the 1954 A Star Is Born, which was the first time that story had been done as a musical. It's been done as a musical ever since. But she is extraordinary in that film. And in fact, Dave, you know, who is now like super into Judy Garland, did kind of blew her off for a long time because he's like, all right, yeah, Wizard of Oz is great, but it was kind of a cliche among gay men from the 60s onward. They're like, oh, you worship Judy Garland, you know? And so he, of course, being a contrarian, is like, I don't, not interested. And then I showed him A Star Is Born. And she does a song in that movie called The Man That Got Away, which is just a gut-wrenching, like, dude has left me number. She shoots it in one take, live on the set, And he said it was like watching punk rock, like that she is so nakedly emotional and lurching toward the camera and like not filtering anything and just giving you so much raw emotion that it blew him away. And then he went back and, you know, thanks to Turner Classic Movies, went and has seen every single movie she ever made. So that's the movie that converted him. I still haven't even seen every movie she's ever made, but I'm a huge, like, Star is Born 1954 is my favorite of all the versions. I think they all have things going for them, but her number particularly, but the movie in general, George Cukor directed it. It's stunning and powerful and still holds up and was chopped to bits and then thankfully restored in the 80s. So you can see it at its full length. And it's really great.
That's what's crazy about Judy is she was worked to the bone, but like, she's incredible. Like if that was me, I would just be all mopey. Like I wouldn't show up. Like I'd be like, all right, I'll come, but you're not going to get my best. Like she does it.
Yeah, no. I mean, she was doing this literally from infancy and just, you know, like just would, and you know, obviously, yes, the later she got, like her work became erratic or her showing up on time became erratic because, you know, they'd been pumping pills into her at MGM from a very young age. Right. But like in A Star is Born, even though she was going through these same issues that would plague her for most of her life, like she and her then husband, Sid Luft, were producing this movie. It was sort of her... she was kind of getting to run the show more than she had in the past. She wasn't under contract at a studio. This was like her baby. And, you know, it was not long after she had gotten fired from MGM. And it was sort of her opportunity to kind of show the world, look, I'm capable of this. I can do this. And she was robbed of an Academy Award that year, if you ask me. But the Oscars almost never get it wrong. So why should this be any different?
Is there another like year in the life movie that comes to mind that's similar to this?
You put me on the spot.
I'm sorry.
I'm sure there are. And if y'all want to leave some in the comments, it's one of those things. The second you asked me, my brain went, what? You know, so yes, there are. I just can't think of what they are at the moment.
It's a really cool way to tell a story without like you said, it's not heavy on the plot. Go ahead.
There's a British movie from a couple of years ago directed by the great Mike Leigh called Another Year. And it is about a year in the life of this couple and their family and friends. And it's terrific.
Well, there you go. Yeah. It's like, it doesn't have to be like life itself is a plot. So like just seeing somebody evolve over the course of a year in and of itself is plot enough. Like you don't have to go crazy. So kudos to that. All right. I'm ready to tell everybody.
Okay. The headphones are coming off.
We are going to watch the 1998 classic starring Jonathan Taylor Thomas, I'll Be Home for Christmas. I don't know if Alonzo's ever seen it. I was trying to think of one that he probably wouldn't have seen. I think this is one that could have passed him by. We'll see. All right. That's it. We're good. I'm excited because I looked through the list and I think I maybe found one that you would have just let pass you by.
Okay.
So that's the one that we're going with. So I'm excited about that.
We'll just see about that.
We will see. Until then, Alonzo, may I be the first to wish you, buddy, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Deck the Hallmarks of Bramble Jam podcast. It's presented by Philo TV. It's produced by Brandon Gray and recorded live in, Greenville, South Carolina. Set decor is by Plum at Haywood Mall. For more information on Deck the Hallmark, you can go to deckthehallmark.com. For more information on Bramble Jam Podcast Network, you can go to bramblejampodcast.com.